Welcome back to Bubble Trouble, the training set for every skeptical large language model, with the ever-critical independent analyst Richard Kramer. That's me. And the economist, author, music geek, and unrelenting statistics nerd, Will Page. If there's a bubble that burst, we like to think we pricked it first. This week, we have Linda Yu, author of The Great Crashes, and that is with a plural, and I have the feeling that we'll have several more, maybe even before this podcast ends. Lessons from Global Meltdowns and How to Prevent Them. Good luck with that. But Linda is going to talk with us about why we seem to always have trouble with bubbles. And we'll be back in a moment with Will's introduction.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Linda, welcome to the world-class, state-of-the-art Platoon Studios here in dreary, wet North London. Thank you for coming into the studio. To introduce you to our audience, which is in America and UK, they'll be familiar with your work on the BBC. And it seems a little bit surreal that we're going to interview you, because I would say, hands down, you're one of the best interviewers in the business. A Linda Yu interview is one where you don't know where it's going to go next. So there's always a sense of anticipation. So should I just rip up the script and give you the microphone to interview us? I don't know. But we'll try it. We'll try the reverse roles here. But you've got a new book out. You've got many fingers and many pies. Why don't you just take a minute to tell our audience about what you're doing just now, and really important, how our audience can follow your work?
Oh, thank you so much, Will. I'm so looking forward to this, and what a beautiful place this is. And so I was at the BBC, and then I returned to academia. So I'm at Oxford and London Business School, and I am delighted to have written. This is actually my 11th book, but 9 of these books are not readable because they're academic books. So
I hope the circulation will get over 83, and that includes the copies 83. Your mother, your cousins, and your extended family bought.
There's a decimal point in 8 points.
Thank you, Will. He knows me well. So I'm absolutely, what was fascinating, I should say, just about writing this book is that I do actually write about having been there for a number of these crashes. So
a front row seat.
Yeah, front row seat. And you know how they say sometimes journalism is the first draft of history. I sort of felt that, you know, as everything came crashing down around me, making sense of it actually years later by writing this book was to me just, you know, really interesting. And then thinking, well, actually, I was there, and I was there, and I was there. And what did I, you know, what did I learn? And I think that's really what made me write this book. Hopefully, you know, as Richard already says, there's probably a crash happening right now. But, you know, the subtitle is Lessons from Global Meltdowns and How to Prevent Them. So it's to prevent having another global financial crisis, which was as bad as the Wall Street crash in 1929, you know, but will never prevent the next crisis.
And just quickly, in terms of how the book came around, I think this is very important for our audience to appreciate, is both as a professional journalist and as an academic and an author now, you do your homework. And there's economics, pop economics books coming off the conveyor belt one every minute, literally. But this was not just a fly-by-night affair. How many months/years have you put into this book? Tell us about the depth of research that went into this effort.
So this took about 3 years.
Wow.
And as you say, because I'm an academic, especially when you write about history, you know, there's this joke, you know, why will you listen to an economist forecast? They can't even tell you what happened in the past. And I think, and that means that when you do your research, you do have to be, I think, just very mindful of the different interpretations of what's happened before. So, you know, and I really enjoyed your book because it was just about that depth. And that's what I strove for here. Accessible, understandable, because that's the journalist in me, but the depth and the nuance, which is often missing from, you know, from a lot of books. And I think importantly, I don't try and push a point of view. I try to give the reader enough facts and tools so that they can make an assessment about impact.
And to be clear for the audience, you don't need a degree in economics to read this book. This book is preaching to the unconverted.
Completely. And in fact, one of the reasons it took so long to write is because I made it very accessible. So I'll just give you an example of what I mean. So, you know, when an economist defines a recession, it's like two consecutive negative quarters of shrinking GDP. Really catchy. And then you go on to define depression. So I define it in the book as a recession is when your neighbor loses his job. A depression is when you lose your job. And that is an old economist joke. And it was famously repeated by Ronald Reagan when he was running against Jimmy Carter for the U.S. presidency in 1979. His version was, a recession is when your neighbor loses his job. A depression is when I lose my job. And the recovery is when Jimmy Carter loses his job. And he won the election.
And do you know that Ronald Reagan was the first PR president of the United States? And the famous PR trick that his team did was they'd only ever put him in front of journalists when he was about to board a helicopter and the rotator blades were turning so he couldn't hear the questions. Very clever. You just hold his hand to his ear and say, God bless America, let's go into the helicopter, Nancy. You couldn't get stung with questions. I think last thing is to tee up before Richard takes you through the book, but this, you have this kind of very interesting three bases of understanding how this happens. And now, who am I to give the professor of media any media training? But I always taught that the best way to answer a question in a podcast is to start with the word imagine, because you illustrate these three points of crises, of depressions that happen. You want to just, for our audience's benefit, illustrate this kind of self-reinforcing prophecy of depressions.
Yeah, that's a wonderful tip. So every crisis through history roughly has three phases. And so if you imagine a brilliant new technology comes about. Right now, you'll think about AI, but in the dot-com era, it was this, wow, you could actually buy something without going into a physical store. You can order it from the internet. And so this exuberance, sometimes irrational, this euphoria leads to bubbles because everyone piles in. Or to use the jargon of today, it's FOMO, fear of missing out. So the problem is when you do that by borrowing money and you have too much debt. And then when the inevitable bust happens, now we're into the crisis phase. And then how you resolve a crisis is the second phase. So again, imagine you're a policymaker. You have seen these incredible tech companies. What do you do? So the stories that I tell are about policymakers are when they do credible things and then when they do not credible things. So sometimes they do things that you don't believe will work and then it does. So for instance, European Central Bank president, he turns the corner on the euro crisis raging for 2 years by giving a speech. We can talk about that later if you like.
Ad-libbing a speech. Ad-libbing.
Exactly. And then the final phase is the aftermath. And this is where I think it is depressing. We keep going through these. And all the crashes I write about led to recession, where millions of people lost their jobs and there was economic misery. That aftermath depends on the scale of debt, whether banks are affected, and how credible your policymakers are. So there's a lot of crashes that don't lead to recessions. I don't write about those. I write about the great crashes. And that's why that aftermath, I do spend some time on in the book to try and get some lessons so that we cannot have economic misery spread, you know, as much as possible.
So fear of missing out, fear of finding out, and then fear of fallout. FOMO, FOFO, FOFO. That's my new acronyms.
Wow, you're brilliant.
Richard, like a dog off a leash.
I gave him the FOFO one for a long time because I think there's a willful ignorance or a willful blindness. That was one of the best business books of the year some few years back. This notion that we all don't want to acknowledge these bubbles bursting. And just since we started Bubble Trouble, I lost count because we've had Wirecard and Evergrande and Credit Suisse and the Metaverse and Web3 and crypto and SVB. And all of this stuff happened in the last 2.5, 3 years. And we are overwhelmed by it. Now, I read this book and it was like a great gallop through scandal after scandal, crisis after crisis. And there's a couple things I really wanted to drill into. But first, stepping back, at the heart of every single one of these crises was one or two simple things. First, banks. Okay. I mean, from U.S. savings and loans, which you talked about Charles Keating, to the Japanese banks, to Nexia or Bankia or Raiffeisen and Credit Suisse or SVB. I mean, we know bankers have no morals, but can't we accept that they're much more of a hazard? And what is it about banks at the heart of our economy that just constantly creates and fuels these crises?
Yeah, a great question. And I think you've also hit the nail on the head in terms of why these are great crashes, because great crashes lead to recessions, and the worst ones are the ones that drag down the banks, because the banks are where people keep their money. The banks are how you pay your mortgage, how you get a business loan. So when the banks get into trouble, there's a credit crunch, and then the rest of the economy suffers. So this is why some crashes that don't involve banks, you know, are not the scale of the recession in terms of depth and length is not that bad. So obviously 2008 global financial crisis, you know, huge banking crisis. And that's why we spent about a decade, you know, trying to recover from it. And that's what history shows. The worst crises are banking crises, and then also sovereign debt crises. But that's a slightly different, you know, governments borrowing too much as opposed to, you know, banks being overextended. So this is the fascinating thing about banks, which is they are a linchpin in the economy because of all the reasons that I've just described. But because they are the funders of housing and of new exciting businesses, it just seems that we just hit the same cycle repeatedly. And when regulators, you know, put in new regulation, you two will be very familiar with this. You know, they're closing the stable doors after the horses have bolted.
Long after. So to my mind, one of the original sins that caused many of these crises of the last 25 or 30 years was the repeal of Glass-Steagall and the mixing of the staid deposit-taking institution with the incredibly conservative bank manager that gave you the stare when you came in asking to borrow anything, and the freewheeling investment banking side, the casino capitalism, Fred the Shred, one of Will's favorite Scotsmen.
And ex-CEO of RBS.
When I left Scotland, RBS was the biggest financial institution in the world, 2006.
Yeah.
It wasn't for long.
So it is. I understand the function of banks, but isn't there something broader about them constantly being at the heart of these crises that just is goes unrecognized? To me, it was like this thread throughout your book that didn't get drawn out to say, well, we obviously know who the villain of the piece is every time.
Yeah, no, I think this is, it is such a good, important point, because if you look at, I mentioned at the start, debt. So how can you get into debt? Somebody lends you the money, and it's normally the bank. And so, you know, and I think this goes to human nature as well. Because bankers, their clients are, let's take Silicon Valley Bank. They're the ones who are transforming technology. So they're going to be the ones who lend. And then we've had a lot of housing bubbles that I write about. So who do people borrow money for mortgages from? Well, banks. I write about the S&L crisis, savings and loan crisis in the U.S. in the 1980s. Those were simple mortgage offering. You know, they take in deposits, they lend you money for your housing. And then that all imploded in the late 1980s when they found out they were not competitive against, you know, just, you know, banks that were treading into their territory. And then they ventured into that. But anyways, I just want to mention the S&L crisis has a lot of the colorful characters you're talking about, including banks. Mm. But the lesson that we never learn, and I think this is something that I had to say got cut out of the book, is I write about Charles Ponzi in an earlier draft because we know about Ponzi schemes. And I think this is slightly getting to your point, you know, about, so you'll be shocked to hear the Ponzi scheme is named after Charles Ponzi,
yeah,
who was a banker,
yeah,
in the 1920s.
Yeah.
And he had this fantastic thing where he said, you give me your money and I will give you double digit returns on it, or you'd only earn 2 to 3% in a bank. Mm-hmm. And then if you ask them how he did it, he said, you know, that postal reply coupons. I'm arbitraging those. And then his client said, oh, well, just, you know, just like Bernie Madoff, just let me leave my money with you. And then it worked for about 18 months and then it collapsed and then he went to prison. And then when he came out, he has some land to sell you in Florida.
I'm sure. But let me, before I pass the baton back to Will, I want to make a key distinction here. And I think it's so important because we had a podcast about Silicon Valley Bank where I tried to explain that it wasn't the high-flying clients of Silicon Valley Bank.
No,
it was Silicon Valley Bank itself. We called it damned by duration. They were too cool for school. They didn't manage their risk properly.
Yeah.
In the case of the financial crisis, the global financial crisis, and the real estate lending, it was the robo-mortgages by Wells Fargo and the multiple layering on of products. In the savings and loan scandal that you write about, it was Keating faking his numbers, getting caught, going to prison, coming out and faking his numbers again. So I would, in a way, exonerate some of the banks to say it's not always the banks. It's the fact that there's so much bad behavior by these banks. And I'm going to come on to ask you about the regulation of these banks. Isn't it fundamentally a sector that encourages a kind of behavior that will always be sort of forever blowing bubbles and causing crises for us?
I think your point about human nature is the important one because, you know, why do we constantly have another bubble, another crisis? It's because of human nature. Mm. You know, people don't know if it's a bubble or it's a fundamental transformation. It's the same with a banker. And therefore, they end up funding this. And I think what's really worrying today is it's private credit. It's now outside the official banking system. It's called shadow banking, but that's just the general term to capture financial institutions that extend loans but are not don't have a banking license. Mm. So we now have a massive growth in shadow banking and the growth of private credit, and they are now subject to the banking regulations, which at the moment, systemically important, the big banks are subject to.
Right.
So to me, the same human nature, we're struggling to regulate the formal banking sector. And now you've got the shadow banking sector alongside. And then, you know, I've really enjoyed your podcast. And, you know, and I think about, you know, something like Silicon Valley Bank, a mid-tier bank that was considered to be not systemically important. And then this is just like the SNL crisis. You think, oh, well, it's just a savings and loan. They're a low mortgage lender. You know, how important could this be for the whole system? And then when you realize it is, then, and this is the point I'm trying to get to, which is moral hazard is when you know you'll be rescued. So then, therefore, you take more risk.
Right.
And banks are subject to that because they know they're special in the economy. Anytime you have a crisis,
right,
what happens? They will be rescued. Mm. So Silicon Valley Bank, as you know, was essentially, their deposits got rescued way above the deposit insurance limit and for business accounts.
Yeah.
So that is an important trait as to why banks seem to be repeating this behavior, because they are subject to moral hazard.
When you've got them by the balls, your hearts and minds follow.
Yeah. Yeah.
But just to follow on to that, I mean, one of the other things that is a thread throughout your book, you talk about the regulators catching up long after the horse is bolted and long down the track, but the revolving door between regulators and bankers. And the Japan chapter, you talk about how a perk of the job at the Ministry of Finance is to be wined and dined by the junior staff at the banks. And then when you retire from the Ministry of Finance, you get an honorary job back at the bank. And, you know, you had ex-bankers running the FCA in the UK. You had one of the worst SEC chairmen in history, who was the lawyer who did the Alibaba IPO. And we see this in the China banking sector, where there is no dividing line between the state-owned banks and the bank officials. I mean, why is it so glaringly apparent that regulators are not up to the job, and yet we keep up this fig leaf, this fiction that we are somehow on top of or regulating the banks? Let's not go to our podcast about Andrew Bailey and the job that the Bank of England is currently doing in prudential regulation. But how can we perpetuate this ludicrous notion that the regulators know what the heck is going on?
Yeah, I mean, Japan, the one I write about, I think was really stark as to why it resulted in misery for so many people for decades after the real estate crash.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about
a 30-year recession.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? So, I mean, the International Monetary Fund, who goes around, you know, extending credit lines, helping to rescue countries, they say that the first 8 months after a crisis is the crucial period. If you take more than 8 months, you're out for, you're probably in for a bad, you know, outcome, a bad aftermath. So Japan took 8 years because of the cozy relationship between the regulators and the banks. And then you think, like, let me just say 8 months to 8 years, a recession that has dragged on for 3 decades. Just now, the Nikkei 225 has finally recovered to its pre-crash level from the late 1980s.
Right.
I mean, this is just extraordinary. So yes, I think, you know, that's why I write about it, because sometimes you have to take a very stark example to make people go, what? You know, why? How can that be the relationship? And then hope that triggers, you know, that a wider recognition.
But do you think the regulators are up to the job?
Well, it's interesting because most, I would say, in Japan, no. It depends on the country. And it depends, you know. But my general view is the regulators are just, they're always regulating for the last crisis. So the question is, what can they do to keep abreast of, you know, financial innovation? Oh, your podcast listeners can't see my air quotes.
Yeah.
You know, financial innovation. And China's got an interesting example here. So they obviously have a, you know, let's just say a less than perfect regulatory system. So what they do is, apparently, if you are at, you know, a Chinese tech company like, you know, Alibaba when it went to Alipay, offering electronic payments. I've been told that they just, you're the guy doing, you're an Alibaba, you're doing Alipay, you're trying to get into payments. You just, your phone rings like every other hour where the regulator goes, hey, what are you up to? What are you working on right now? And this happens like 8 times a day, every day. And that's a very, you know, it is an attempt to work out what they're doing. Mm. And so I think that's also why we have to be, I think, naturally quite skeptical about how much regulation can do and how much financial innovation is, you know, is really innovation, as in, you know, the sense of, you know, producing the greater good.
Mm. A phone call every hour of the day, that's regulatory oversight on steroids. Richard's alluding to something which has been bugging my base bin for a long time, which is, does anybody actually know what's going on? Never mind the regulators today. Yeah. What about the students today, which could become the regulators tomorrow? One question that's interesting to pose to you was, do you think that the way that we're teaching finance and economics makes people equipped for understanding how this whole thing works? If you were to ask 100 students from LSE today, where does money come from? A really basic question. Where does it come from? On the eighth day, did God just put money into the economy? How does it actually appear? How many could give you a straight answer? Fractional reserve lending. How many people know what that actually means who are studying economics and finance? Do you think there's a problem going forward, which is we're pouring students out into the labour market to work in regulation, to work in banking, who don't actually get the basics?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I personally found fascinating is that, you know, there is a push to do more what we would describe as actual case studies, which is not really part of the basic economic toolkit. You know, when you study economics, you do micro, macro. Maybe for an elective, you do monetary policy and you work out how money goes around the system, or you do money in banking. But, you know, before 2008, banking wasn't even modeled in most macro models. It was just, you know, it was just, this is how you translate money into an invest through to investment.
Remember that, I think they taught your university the ISLM model and nobody knew what LM stood for.
Yeah.
You could ask your professor, can you just break out what the initials stand for? I don't know.
Yeah, no, liquidity money. You know, how important is that?
Skyfall Picks had an idea.
And I think, you know, but the other thing, why I've actually enjoyed writing my last two books, as you know, were both on economic history. I don't think we teach enough history.
Yeah.
And I think this is where you get the actual examples where you can go, ah, okay, I do, by understanding how things were done and then what you need to do differently, you do learn a lot. It actually, what I describe as, you know, sinking in. Sometimes I feel like learning is by osmosis. You sit there and you go, you know, has it really sunk in? And I think sometimes osmosis actually does help, because when you're getting into a tale, I tell a lot of stories of, you know, some pretty colorful people, you know, you start to go, oh, wait, hang on. Why was that okay? How did that happen? And now I understand why banking shouldn't just be a black hole in a macro model. Or now I understand why we now have macroprudential regulation where, you know, central banks lean against the bubble. Because in the past, I tell the story in the book, you know, the Fed chairman in a post-war period said, who wants to be the person who takes away the punch bowl when the party's getting started? Mm. And now after 2008, it became pretty clear you have to lean against the bubble. In other words, when debt becomes too high, you need to restrict loan-to-value on the mortgages that you offer, because the automatic increase of how much you can lend based on an asset, a collateral like housing, just goes up. If the house price goes up, you can lend more. And then you end up with this financial accelerator, as in you say, oh my God, now we have a lot of debt. So what you actually do is you have to, you know, push against it, you know, lend less.
That really resonates with me, the point about osmosis and learning from history. Just to put a pin in that one, it's, for me, you've made me think about, if you learn economic history, it often finishes with the moral of the story is, right, I get it. I get where the bad behavior happened. I get why the bad behavior happened, and I get the ramifications of that bad behavior. You can't say after studying econometrics, the moral of the story is. You just talk about dummy variables and error terms, which yes, confirms the guesswork that's involved in econometrics. So I just want to underline, exclamation mark, put in bold, the relevance of economic history over econometrics.
Well,
I think it's
a
powerful point.
No, I couldn't agree more. I remember there was an article I read once in a journal. It was called When Being Female is no longer a dummy variable, because you put in a regression and you're like, gender difference, I controlled for that. And you're like, oh, so the outcome, like, oh, what's okay? You put it as a dummy variable, all controlled for.
I never understood that. Dummy variables. The model doesn't work. Invent it so it does work. But that's not modeling. That's guesswork with lots of Greek symbols. What's the error term? It's where we put stuff we don't understand. Well, let's understand it. No, we just put it in the error term. I walked out my econometrics classes.
But maybe before we go to the break, this notion of case studies and putting and play acting or role acting in a particular area. I mean, I'm thinking about the TARP and the financial crisis, and I can't escape the feeling that the conversation isn't broad enough, in the sense of the frame of reference is too narrow. You had an ex-Goldman Sachs banker who was the Treasury Secretary succeeding another ex-Goldman Sachs banker as the Treasury Secretary, and somehow they could not agree that Goldman and Morgan Stanley would take a 70-cent or 60-cent haircut on the dollar for the debt of AIG. The U.S. taxpayer had to make those big banks whole. And yes, the U.S. taxpayer got some preference shares, and that's nice. But somehow there's something in this revolving door between bankers and regulators that all agree they don't want to step outside the system, and they allow for what you've clearly described, but you didn't use these words, privatize the gains and socialize the losses. It happens in every crisis. Japan wore those losses for 30 years. The U.S. taxpayer wore them for a decade. The U.K. taxpayer still wore them and had to suffer austerity because of them. And you didn't step outside the frame of reference. You had a U.K. chancellor who was a merchant banker and went back to merchant banking. And where are we missing in the role play in the case studies, the notion that someone should come in from the outside and look at it and say, a pox on all your houses, you're the ones who have to pay. Let's get clawbacks. Bankers don't go to jail. Let's look at, you know, why are we providing public support for these too-big-to-fail institutions when they are clearly just exercising their moral hazard? How do we break that cycle in education and get people to step outside that frame of reference?
Yeah, and it is really important to talk about bail-ins, because that was the change after the euro crisis. Because the euro crisis was so miserable. Because, you know, I just remind everyone, the euro crisis, you know, for those who have intentionally forgotten about it because it was so painful, it was started in 2010 when Greece had a budget problem. They discovered they had a budget hole. But this was in the slipstream of the global financial crisis. So European banks were already on their knees. And then this crisis, I mentioned Mario Draghi at the very start, he didn't turn the corner of it until 2 years later. And so I think there was a real sense in continental Europe that you can't just have taxpayers bailing out, so they're the ones who suffer the losses. You also have to have bail-ins. So those who benefited from the rise in value of bank stocks are the ones who suffer when the banks, you know, collapse. So bail-ins have become part of the toolkit, in at least in the Eurozone. So the European Central Bank, they have put in measures called COCOs, which is, you know, convertible bonds that convert into equity when
how
a bank hits
ironic,
you to
you're suggesting
levels,
so. Banks should be subject to market forces.
Yeah, I know, shocking, isn't it? Commercial banks. And this is a great story I actually tell in the book, because it was so controversial to do bail-ins. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so we know that shareholders, you know, lose because they own the shares. And by the way, shareholders are institutions, but they're also people. bondholders are the ones who didn't lose before. So if you had bail-ins and put, you know, more of the losses not on the taxpayer, in Ireland, I write in the book, would not have had the austerity that it had. But this was such a controversial measure because you're right, we just haven't had it before, that the Eurozone had this massive debate. Your politicians, well, they had a massive debate on everything, but they had a massive debate. And there was only the breakthrough was because Angela Merkel, you know, took a walk.
With Sarkozy.
Yeah, on the beach. They were in Dalville and they were literally walking along the coast. And then they said, we're going to do bail-ins. And then just like that, I remember I was at Bloomberg. They announced it. The market went crazy. You know, like, what is this has, you know, even that most things get priced in. So it was debated. But I think that how it came about. And then now it's part of the toolkit.
But it is astonishing how those pref shares only perpetuated the value destruction by some of the biggest banks in the U.S. The U.S. government owns preference shares in Citibank, and it's underperformed for decades. Yeah. And it just sort of allowed these banks to keep spinning and keep kicking the can down the road. And it ended up coming on the backs of the taxpayers. I think we need to go to the end of part one now.
We should do, but perhaps just sign off by saying you said Citibank. I believe I've heard the internal term is shitty bank, but we'll come back to that later. But at least Merkel and Sarkozy did something, as opposed to Mario Draghi, who said we'll do whatever it takes and proceeded to do nothing. Well, we'll be doing something in part two. We'll be going down many rabbit holes in this wonderful book, The Great Crashes, with Linda Yeo. Thanks, and back in a moment.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back to part two of Bubble Trouble with Linda Yu, talking about the great crashes, lessons from global meltdowns and how to prevent them. We're talking about a wide range of topics right now and a lot of things to pick up on from part one. One of the ones I'd like to extend is we had one of our early podcasts was with a great friend of mine, Jesse Eisinger, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, who wrote a book called The Chicken Shit Club, which was the words that were used by the attorney general in the Southern District of New York to criticize his public sector Department of Justice prosecutors to say, you only take cases you can win. You do these deferred prosecution agreements with all the big banks. You don't throw anyone in jail. You're in the chicken shit club. You're not really trying the hard stuff. And we were just talking in the break about how is it that you've had this long trail of malfeasance, which you document in your book, but no one went to jail. Where is the culpability, the responsibility? How is it that Fred the Shred still has his £30 million pension in this era, which has produced these crises really like clockwork every half decade or decade?
And I think increasingly, what we were just saying in the break, this is the question that I think at a festival that you and I have both gone to.
I haven't been there yet. They haven't invited Bubble Trouble, but we'd love to do a Bubble Trouble there.
So I've been to this festival, which mixes economics and comedy, because if you don't laugh, you will cry.
<You're right.
laughs> And so it's interesting because some of the, if you just look at the UK, they have put in things, and it's the same, I would say, on both sides of the Atlantic and in the Eurozone as well. Things like the senior manager's regime, you know, things like malice. So, you know, but the question of ill-gotten gains really doesn't sit very well. And I think that's why I've mentioned I've been to this festival for over a decade. And, you know, and it is something that we just keep going back and, you know, forth about. Mm. So now I'm going to go to China as an example. Economic crime is a big deal. In China, you would go to prison and probably worse.
Yep. But you have, I wanted to come on to China, and maybe we'll come on to it a little later, but if you think about the structure of China, that is almost, the analogy I came up with reading your book and talking about China is that you can see there's an iceberg through the fog. And you know that the iceberg, in the case of the state-owned banks, the four large state-owned banks, is much larger under the surface of the water than you could ever see at the top. And you can't see what's at the top anyway because it's swirling in the fog. And when you look at a banking system like China, where regulation and the banks are one and the same entity, because they're all the state, how does it decouple and evolve? Does it? Or are we looking at the mother of all crises in China when the likes of an Evergrande or a Country Garden just say, well, we just can't pay back that $300 billion of money we borrowed?
Yeah, there's so much there. So, yes, that's my in my book, I finish with the next great crash.
Yeah, you do.
Let me just give my caveat. When I was starting out in economics, I was given a bit of advice. You should either forecast the event or the timing, but never both. So I have no idea when China will crash. But the reason I write about it,
is that the origins of a hedge fund?
But, you know, it's overdue for one. It's very unusual not to have had one. And it's got all of the signs that I write about in my book, which are telltale signs. Mm. So, you know, the property bubble, which has begun to burst, the amount
it
of
has
debt.
Has well and truly burst. Yeah, it certainly has burst.
And I guess the question, the worry is, as you say, we don't really know what's
right.
on the balance sheet
right.
of Chinese banks because, well, they don't mark to market. So, you
Correct.
Know, they don't necessarily immediately start to impact their
acknowledge,
balance sheet.
Acknowledge yeah. the issue.
And then they also get quietly recapitalized.
Yeah.
But what worries me about China is that Evergrande, that's the world's most indebted property company, only the second biggest in China, Country Garden, the biggest, is also mm-hmm. in trouble. Their inability to repay their debt, so they're pretty much, you know, they're really struggling. It's beginning to impact the trust sector. So this is the shadow banks. So China's trust sector, so this includes everything that we just said, you know, basically funds or anything which could lend money but doesn't have a banking license. So that sector is huge, and we don't know how big because it's part of the shadow banking sector. So now you have contagion, and now you have to worry about the aftermath because the Chinese property sector with related services is 29% of the entire economy.
Mm.
So anything that happens is going to deeply impact people and households and the country, and not just focused on China itself, but China is the world's biggest official lender.
Yes.
So it could also trigger an emerging markets crisis because lots of developing countries rely on Chinese banks and the Chinese state, which are pretty much the same thing in most cases,
yeah.
you know, for monies that, you know, might just dry up. And so that's why I write about China, because I think we just need to pay attention to it.
Absolutely. But it's okay because they publish the GDP statistics 2 weeks after the end of the quarter. They're always right. They never revise the numbers. But over to Will.
Sticking with China, switching lanes slightly, in the interest of balance, we're doing some China bashing here. But something, Richard, you said at the Financial Times Weekend Festival, which really stunned the audience, was you looked at how China's approach to big tech was different from that of the West. And I'd love to hear Linda's opinions on that. Richard, do you want to just sort of summarize the way you approached it? Because this really turned a lot of heads in the room and on our podcast soon afterwards.
Well, look, we can talk about regulatory capture in every domain. And you have a brilliant example of it in Japan where, I mean, the regulators are going out to dinner every day with the companies they're being regulated by. And then when they retire, they get jobs at those companies. So it's pretty captured. But I think China just simply looked at the tech billionaires in the U.S. as an unelected class expressing political opinions and said, we don't want that. And we're not going to stand for it. And the minute that one of them, one of the most prominent ones, stepped out of line and started to make some comments about the ways in which banks were regulated, he was pretty much disappeared, if you can use that as a verb. You know, he reappeared like 18 months later in painting or something in Spain or Japan. You know, we cited Jack Ma. But the Chinese government just decided we don't want the opinions of those tech billionaires to be, you know, the dictating policy. And they took a top-down approach, whereas in the U.S., and the West, those companies are able to buy the influence that they need, and they operate largely untrammeled. And that's not just tech, but it's in every sector. I mean, and that bigness, that concentration, you have big ag and big pharma and big cable and big media. And, you know, those concentrations have happened in every sector of the economy without the regulators stepping in. And China just said, we're not having it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, and it's really interesting because a lot of tech companies in China, they would tell you they survived despite the government.
Yeah. Wow.
So Jack Ma's problem is that he stuck his head, you know, above the parapet. And there's a saying in Chinese, which is something like, kill the chicken to scare the monkey. So they make examples out of people.
I think you've given us the title of this podcast.
Yeah. Kill the chicken to scare the monkey.
I have no idea why they pick chickens and monkeys, by the way. But I think the, you know, this idea that the state has to be in control, but they know the private sector, especially tech companies, are the ones that foster the growth that China
and
needs.
And innovation. Yeah.
Yeah, and innovation. I think the way they've done it is like what they've done for most of the past 40 years, which is, it's called the no encouragement, no ban policy.
Yeah.
So you don't stick your head above the parapet. And then if you are one of the Made in China 2025 strategic pillars, so this is, you know, this is AI, this is chips, you know, you get a lot of government subsidies. So, you know, you describe the U.S. system as quite captured, and China is captured in a different way.
Yeah.
You know, and it's one of the big unknowns, which is you need to foster innovation, but you also need to have guardrails around it. China puts a lot of guardrails on the ones they notice. But whether or not that's going to improve people's lives, to me, that's the unknown question.
So
you know,
the printing on the T-shirts would say, who does the dancing and who calls the tune?
Yes, try.
But it's fascinating right now that you have a battle going on in the U.S. between a very activist chairman of the SEC, Gary Gensler, and the banks. And for the first time in living memory, you have an SEC chairman who isn't just a quisling. It just isn't just sort of there to rubber stamp what the banks want to do. And it's going to be very interesting to see how that plays out, because some of the things that he's proposing would mean that the banks potentially make a good bit less money or aren't able to behave as they have in the past. And what is, to me, rather clear, and I think Will and I agree on this, is that the $600 billion or so of fines that have been paid by the banking sector in the last 20 years – and there's no major bank name that you can mention, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Credit Suisse, UBS. They've all paid billions and billions of fines. That has just been a cost of doing business. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you think about that as one of the ways to prevent crises, because it hadn't worked. Mm-hmm. Saying I'm going to fine you $6 billion because I caught you doing something bad when your profits in the year were $26 billion. Well, it's just, you know, margins will go down a little bit this year, they'll go back up next year.
No, it's interesting because a lot of organizations talk about who's accountable. And so to me, that's sort of, isn't that the question, which is, if you're responsible, why is the fine coming out of the bank's profit pool? And we know when you tax profit, you don't change behavior, because profit by definition is not part of your marginal cost or your marginal, right, you know, benefit curves. And so generally speaking, mm-hmm, profit tax is non-distortionary. But maybe in this case, it should be distortionary.
Right.
You know?
Because the profit is what the shareholders get after the bankers
That's
have taken their
right.
cut.
So why is it not the actors themselves, you know.
I like where this is going. But let me come back to the book. The title of the book, or the subtitle, is Lessons from the Global Meltdown and How to Prevent Them. So if our audience was to read this book, and if they were all to buy it in the same week, we'd have a bestseller, because that's how bestsellers work, is concentration of demand in 1 week. How to prevent them? If policymakers were to read this book, they'd say we have levers. That's the term they always use, levers. We have policy levers to navigate this crisis. Long question short, do those levers work anymore? I mean, I'm just thinking, if a child was born when inflation got above the rate of interest, they'd be finishing their GCSEs this year. So we've had 16 years of dysfunctional monetary environment. We have antiquated stats. We have a tech economy which isn't captured in GDP. Halvarian famously showed me that the GVA of the smartphone in America was zero, because it all gets transferred back to Taiwan, Korea, and China. What levers do policymakers have, if any, to navigate the next great crash?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, I think, so We talked briefly about the China chapter. So what I do is I take the levers, you know, what they could do, and I apply it to how you prevent the China crash from becoming a great crash. So I separate them into basically the same three categories. The first phase is, how do you prevent, you know, too much debt going into the sector? So you could do macroprudential tools. Like I said, property values go up. You don't lend more, you lend less. You literally dampen the cycle. You monitor leverage ratios.
That's dangerously like common sense. Please, yes, come on. You're taking a stupid pill there.
And my conclusion is, oh, by the way, it's too late for China now on that point. So we'll just move on to the second point, which is, and the second point is, now you're in a, you know, so now you're in a crash. What are the tools you can use to credibly backstop? And I'm going to now rush, I'm going to jump to the US and say, we've talked about moral hazard and we can debate whether there's consequences from it. But when you see a bank about to go under, you should, if you don't have bail-in tools, which, you know, as I said, that's a Eurozone thing, then what, you know, the U.S. government did with Silicon Valley Bank is that they essentially just, you know, they just rescued the whole thing. They recapitalized effectively. So that's normally what they do. Now, if it's not a banking crash and say it's a stock market crash, then we're back to the economic tools that you're describing. So what happened after the dot-com bubble burst? Interest rates were cut extremely low. What was the consequence of that? Well, let's see. People now didn't put their money into stocks because the dot-com bubble, when it crashed in 2000, led to the NASDAQ didn't recover until 2015. Mm-hmm. So they weren't going to put their money into stocks. So they put it into housing. So then you just lead into the next bubble. And then
whack-a-mole.
Yeah, exactly. And then, so, you know, if you... the other tool is fiscal policy. So governments are really indebted now, and I would throw China in the same category. So the other way to make sure that a crash doesn't translate into a recession is to use government money to create demand and to use public support. China has a very small welfare state. They just don't have the mechanism to do that. You can argue in the West they would struggle because they're so indebted. So to me, those are the levers. It's always regulatory, and then it's economic policy, which is both monetary interest rates and the government spending, which is fiscal. Now, if you're not credible, you can do all this and not be credible, then you still end up with a bad outcome, a bad aftermath. But if you are credible, you act quickly, you act decisively, you may be able to prevent it from being a great crash because you'll never prevent the next crash. But always beware that, as Mark Twain said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. Yeah. You might be laying the foundation for the next crash, which is arguably what happened after the dot-com leading up to the subprime crisis in 2000.
Just to pick up on two related points there, you talk in the book about the Juncker effect, which is the politicians know what to do, but if they do it, they won't get elected again. So fine. You
Juncker
want to do the
curse.
Right thing or not,
yeah.
Right? That's the Juncker curse. But we had a podcast. I had to look it up because my aging memory is going there with Chris Leonard, who wrote Lords of Easy Money, about Thomas Hoenig, the sole dissenter at the Fed, saying having zero interest rates is going to lead to tremendous inequality. And my question with what you just laid out is, are policymakers aware of the consequences of their actions longer term? Or are they just in a crisis, you know, there's a massive thunderstorm and your roof has just collapsed and you start an electrical fire in the basement. So the house is burning from the basement up and flooding from the roof down. What do you do? You're not thinking about, well, what are we going to 3 years from now, how are we going to look? How's the gazebo going to look? And is the garden going to, I want my garden design to be just right. I mean, do people in those situations think through the consequences? Or have we got into zero interest rate policy and you can't get out of it because we were there for a decade?
The economist in me is thinking this is a game theory question. Is it a finite game or an infinite game?
That's right. Can we do backwards induction to get to the outcome? I mean, it is a great, it's another great question. Both of you have such great questions. I think Milton Friedman, you know, the great economist, he said, never judge a policy by its intentions, but by its outcomes. And we are in a world where everything is judged by its intentions. But we intended to make sure a regional banking crisis didn't become a systemic crisis.
Right.
But we intended for, you know, and I think that is the problem in many ways, because the unintended consequences are not, they're not known unknowns.
Right.
You know, they're known knowns. Right. Like, you know, if there's too much cash or, right. you know, negative interest rates, real interest rates, because, you know, interest rates are at zero. Yeah. It's how you try and put out the fire and then limit the impact of that policy. And I think there's been quite a lot of debate about whether interest rates were left too low for too long. I should write about that in, again, leading up to 2008, because, and this is something which I do think, I already talked about how they need to look at banks. They also need to look at international bond markets, because when the Fed finally started raising interest rates after the dot-com bubble burst, they found that it didn't really raise the cost of borrowing. Because as we know, the interest rate is what the central bank sets. The cost of borrowing is what bond markets set. And so it turns out that, you know, emerging markets like China were buying lots and lots of U.S. treasuries. So they were lowering borrowing costs because the unintended consequence of the lesson they learned from the Asian financial crisis just a few years before is we need to have a lot of FX reserves. Right. We need to buy a lot of safe treasuries.
Stable, safe.
Yeah, and put it into our FX reserves. So they were buying up, you know, treasuries, which meant the Fed was raising rates, but you did not see the movement in bond yields. And that's what determines your mortgage rate.
Right.
You know, bank loan, business loans. And that to me is, you know, is a really important lesson to learn, which is there are so many unintended consequences. You got to sit back and go, okay, hang on. Why is it not moving the yield curve? You know, so that's the cost of borrowing across different years in the United States. And then just ask yourself, therefore, what do we do? Because interest rates is the cost of money. You can also just control the quantity of money, which we know is not perfect, but you only have two options. It's either the cost or the price or the quantity. So to me, that's a great lesson to draw out. You have to be aware of unintended consequences.
But then it's also the thing that, again, the frame of reference question for me is that if Thomas Hoenig stood up at the Fed and said, this is going to massively increase inequality if we do this for the next 10 years, were some people okay with that? And saying, you know what? But my billionaire friends are all loving the fact that, and the large banks, the 26 banks who buy treasuries from the U.S. government and then get to resell them for whatever they want to the market and get an automatic cut of that, they think that's fine. And they know that they'll be able to make a lot of money if that Fed funds rate is low. Is the frame of reference that the consequences are intended and they're malevolent, or is the unintended consequence just ignorance on the part of the policymakers? And that's what I'm just not sure about.
There's actually been quite a lot of studies, as you would imagine, since rates have been zero, as you were just saying, you know, you've been at school, this is all you've ever known. Which, by the way, is actually frightening.
Because
I think, you know, it's... So like now when rates are like 5%, people are like, oh, my God. And I was like, that's what it was before 2008.
How many editions of a macroeconomic textbook have changed in this climate where macroeconomics doesn't make any sense?
Yeah, I know. I was just like, well,
this is the fourth edition of it not making any sense.
And so
there'll be a fifth coming along soon.
So, I mean, in this period, there now have been, you know, quite a number of studies, which is providing the evidence to convince those that even if they knew and didn't care or that they didn't care, they have to care.
Right.
So distributional consequences, you know, so...
The Gini coefficient spiked like crazy.
Exactly.
You're getting all these various social issues because of it.
Exactly. And that's why the U.S. Yeah. And that's why the U.S. is now, it's so unequal, it's known as the Second Gilded Age.
Yeah,
so, you know, the
sure.
First Gilded Age was the latter part of the 19th century, famously captured by F. Scott Fitzgerald, you know, later on in his book, The Great Gatsby. And, you know, and I think, so one of the things that, this is actually in my previous book, The Great Economist, I do write about how, you know, the reason you have a backlash against a number of things, including the existing economic system, is because the distribution is so unequal.
Right.
So before you do a policy, you should put yourself behind a veil of ignorance. So this is the ethical lens, which is promulgated by, you know, economists like Samuelson, and he's picking up on John Rawls's theory of justice, the veil of ignorance. If you stand behind it and you go, I don't know if I'm going to have to pay for this or if I'm going to be the one who's going to suffer from this policy, what do you choose? You're going to choose this latter. You know, so if you think Wall Street is going to gain and Main Street is going to suffer, and that's what we've seen in all of these crises, the market rushes ahead, overall GDP is increasing, and then the economy limps along, and real wages in the United States haven't increased since the 1980s.
Yep.
Of course, there's a backlash.
Yep.
And so if you had more of a concern about distribution and inequality, you may actually find the economy grows better, you have more political cohesion and more of a consensus. And we have had it before. Yep. Even in the 50s and 60s, known as the golden age of growth. Yeah. Yeah. You had the looming Cold War. You had massive threats of nuclear war, post-war rebuilding, lots of acrimony. But you also had a lot of cooperation, the growth of global institutions, and most importantly, the golden age of growth.
Yeah. And the, most importantly, a musical revolution. Even. I think that's the correlation, causation.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
And Led Zeppelin.
It is.
Head to the 70s. That was, you were talking about the 50s and 60s. But it's absolutely the case that we have allowed the billionaire donor class to set policy and become enthrall of them. And that's true throughout the West. We need to go to smoke signals, Will.
If we can, but I want to squeeze one quick question
okay.
in for
okay.
the prime purpose for our audience. We've learned through audience feedback, the reason people listen to Bubble Trouble is to impress friends at dinner parties. And I thought, given that a lot of people who have entered two-year mortgages will be coming soon to the end of those teaser rates and staring at a potential financial time bomb, I wanted to ask the mortgage question, which is, we've had a supply-side shock.
Yeah.
A war in Ukraine sent inflation through the roof, and banks raised rates in response to a supply-side shock. Is it fair to say that raising interest rates doesn't solve the war in Ukraine, therefore won't solve inflation? Solving the war in Ukraine solves inflation irrespective of interest rates. That is, did Andrew Bailey and his counterparts around the world need to move in response to supply-side shock, given the cost to demand that action had? Should we be angry about what's going to happen to mortgage rates when those two-year teasers run out?
I think we should be very worried about what happens to interest rates when, you know, two-year... And in fact, even people as we speak now...
People getting mortgages at 0.99%?
I know.
Those days are gone.
Yeah.
Welcome back, Taylor Rule.
Yeah. Actually, I was at a conference with John Taylor, and he was, you know, I think he was pretty pleased that his mechanical rule seems to just cut through all of that.
It just hasn't cut through for the past decade.
I was going to say, he was sitting there going, if my rule would have said, and you know.
I looked at his Spotify account, and his most played song is Since You've Been Gone.
It's one of the things that economists love, right? Something named after them. So that's why every conference, you know, you sort of, so I'm going to, you know, look for the page rule.
So we've got to ask you about, get to our final section of our podcast, which if you listen to, you know, it's smoke signals. It's those, you've looked at all these crises, you've had a front row seat from Bloomberg and the BBC and elsewhere. What are those uh-oh moments when you're just on the cusp of one of these lovely conflagrations? You know, you just saw the spark get lit in the dry tinderbox of the barn, and you just know there's going to be a raging inferno shortly.
Yeah.
What are a couple things that you would tell people to look out for? Like, you've got to beware when you see them coming.
And if I could steer the interviewee here, I'd love, I mean, pick whatever signals you want, but I'd love to hear it from a journalistic perspective. If you have an anecdote about interviewing a crisis maker in the front row, in the front seat, on camera, how they've approached answering questions where you thought, no, this person doesn't have a clue what's going on. if there's an anecdote from your world of journalism, I'd love to hear it.
Oh, these are such good points to end on. Okay, so I would say, I was in Ireland on the eve of the rescue. So remember, Ireland was the first country really to, you know, I mean, it had a horrible crisis, but it, you know, aside from Greece, which is having huge, you know, problems, it wasn't clear at that point if there would be a lot of contagion, which is the term that we used all the time. So I was at a conference in Ireland, and we thought that Ireland, and this comes to your smoke signals, you know, point, is when you have a country with a lot of debt. So Ireland at the time rescued the banks. So that meant that its deficit,
ballooned,
its government deficit, how much it borrows versus how much it has, how much it borrows because it doesn't have enough tax revenues to pay for the bailouts and the guarantees they put on the banks. It was over 30% of GDP. Mm-hmm. So the smoke signal is debt.
Yeah.
So you can pile in, but, you know, but it's the debt. That's the signal. So I was there with a number of other journalists from the Financial Times and other places. And I was talking to the central bank governor at the time. And now remember, we are all thinking, you're going to be rescued and there's going to be contagion in the Eurozone because this is extremely worrying. And he said to all of us, no, the IMF is not. It's not rescuing us. We are, you know. And if you, by the way, the IMF was literally hovering in the air and then the IMF landed shortly thereafter. But this is a lesson about crisis management, right? So we thought it was coming. He couldn't have said anything else. Because the minute he said, we're in crisis, we're going to be rescued, money would just leave Ireland.
Right.
It becomes, this is
why
when
Cyprus.
You
could never admit.
Yeah, so this is, and this is why it's challenging, right? So if you think about Cyprus, it closed down all the banks during the euro crisis. So every time you want to fix the banks, you have to do it over a weekend. Because the minute you get a clue that the banks are going to shut down, people will move their money out of banks and out of your country if they think you're going to put in capital controls. And so for all the policymakers that I've interviewed during the euro crisis, and actually, you know, since then and before then, I always felt that. And I have to say afterwards, I think he came up to me and said, you know, you wouldn't have expected me to say anything else. And that is really tricky because remember, the resolution of a crisis is their credibility. So their credibility is so hard to maintain in a crisis. And, you know, so maybe they should all go, you know, down the Alan Greenspan route, you know, the old Fed chairman. He had to ask his wife 3 times to marry him because she wasn't sure what he was asking.
Well, she was also a very famous TV journalist and a very attractive woman. And Alan Greenspan was, you know, may well have been a brilliant guy, but not, you know, not movie star looks. So, you know.
But I just finished with this smoke signal. And maybe I write a little bit about how people should think about it. But before I give you this, my view or advice, let me just give you the biggest caveat, which is, please don't rely on anything I say for investment advice.
Of course. And
please consult a professional. But I outline in the book what it means for you. So if you see a lot of an exciting development, it's hard to avoid FOMO. You're going to pile in. Just don't do it with a lot of debt. And then if you are in the middle of one of these horrible great crashes or a horrible recession or a crisis, don't crystallize those losses. So what I mean is, if you're about to think, oh, I could take out a lump sum for my pension, which is how the UK system works, if you take it out when you're in the middle of a crisis, you've crystallized the losses of your pension, which is invested mostly in government debt and in shares. So take professional advice and realize what goes up will go down. What goes down will go up. And just try and make sure that you're well-equipped when you're on the down, because then you'll be much better positioned when the inevitable up happens. Although in some cases, it could take 30 years. Like
it could take 30 years. But I think to bring it to a close, I mean, your book title is telling us we are going to have a sequel. Because we will have Linda on a podcast in a decade's time, having been through another half a dozen crises. Hopefully not global crises. Certainly one coming sometime in the next decade, at least in China, if not elsewhere. And we'll be curious to see if any of the lessons learned are applied this time.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you for coming to this world-class studio at Apple to talk to you about the book published by Penguin Random House, available now on Audible as well, I have to say. And you read the book yourself.
Which
is an added benefit because your voice is hypnotizing. This has been fantastic to have you on the show, and I wish the book all the success. And I can also wrap up by saying I really hope that we get to see you go back into journalism and quiz some of these people who put the book into practice. Maybe that's where we need to hear your voice next.
Yes, and just as a last thing, it says on the back a quote from Christine Lagardère, president of the ECB, an important contribution that can help society, but she does not promise to apply any of the lessons of the book. So we'll just leave it at that.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you all so much. Such a pleasure.
If you're new to Bubble Trouble, we hope you'll follow the show wherever you listen to podcasts. And please share it on your socials. Bubble Trouble is produced by Eric Newsom, Jesse Baker and Julia Nett at Magnificent Noise. You can learn more at bubbletroublepodcast.com. Until next time, from my co-host Richard Kramer, I'm Will Page.
Hold up. Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.